I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Midday. Governor Larry Hogan has vowed to stay in office and keep working while he undergoes treatment for what he called very aggressive and very advanced non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. The 59-year-old governor's announcement of his cancer diagnosis leads this hour of Midday Politics with Barry Raskivar, Kimberly Moffitt, and Max Hilaire. We'll also talk about the move in Maryland and in other states away from symbols of the Confederacy in the aftermath of the racist killings in Charleston, South Carolina. Locally, that could mean renaming Robert E. Lee Park. And Mayor Stephanie Rawlings Blake is now president of the U.S. Conference of Mayors, and she's calling for a national bipartisan approach to urban problems like those that surfaced with April's unrest in Baltimore. Midday Politics, after the news. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome back to Midday. Dan Rodericks here. Thanks again for joining us. In this hour of the show is Midday Politics. Maryland Governor Larry Hogan announced yesterday that he has been diagnosed with aggressive late stage 3 cancer. In a late afternoon press conference, Governor Hogan revealed that he has non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, a cancer of the body's lymphatic system, which includes lymph nodes, the spleen, and other organs. He is to begin aggressive chemotherapy immediately, the governor said, and he will rely on Lieutenant Governor Boyd Rutherford to fill in for him while his 18-week treatment takes place.
Over the coming months, I'll be receiving multiple very aggressive chemotherapy treatments. Most likely, I'm going to lose my hair. You won't have these beautiful gray locks. I may trim down a little bit, but I won't stop working to change Maryland for the better. I'll be working hard and making the decisions that the people of this state elected me to make. The fact is that I'm just like the more than 70,000 people diagnosed with lymphoma every single year who fight it, beat it, and continue doing their jobs at the same time. With my faith, my family, and my friends, I know that I won't just beat this disease, but that I'll be a better and stronger person and governor when we get to the other side of it.
Governor Hogan, yesterday afternoon for this edition of Midday Politics, I'm joined by Barry Raskivar of the Political Maryland blog. Barry, nice to see you again.
Always a pleasure, Dan.
Max Hilaire is back with us, chair of the Political Science Department at Morgan State University. Welcome back to Midday, Max.
Thank you, Diane.
And joining us for the second day in the row, nice to have her back in the studio with us, is Kimberly Moffitt, Associate Professor of American Studies at UMBC, the University of Maryland, Baltimore County.
Thank you.
Nice to have you here again, Kimberly. So, yeah, you left our studio yesterday, as I did in the afternoon, and then, we get a notice. I got a notice, at least from the Baltimore Sun newsroom, that the governor was calling a press conference at 4 p.m. Not sure what this was about. And then we found out.
Yeah, everyone thought it was about the Purple Line in the Washington suburbs.
Oh, really? That was the buzz?
That this was the big transportation announcement.
Yeah.
And then they walked in, and there are no transportation people to be found in the room.
Hmm. So, yeah, we were anticipating that the governor has to make a decision about funding the Red Line and the Purple Line.
The Purple Line is more advanced, and also I think it's easier to come up with a deal on the Purple Line so that it can move forward with less expense for the state.
Well, that was a stunning announcement from the governor. It was remarkable the way he handled it.
Yeah, you have to give him a lot of credit. It took considerable courage to come out with that much personal information that he divulged. And the transparency there, I think, is a wonderful thing for the public, the Maryland public. That's one of the reasons that Larry Hogan was elected, because he is sort of your average guy who is not going to politically hide behind anything. He's going to be out front with people. And that's what you saw yesterday. And I think it's very welcome. And it's going to serve as, an eye opener for many, many people about this type of cancer.
to have a public figure. This has happened before in other states. Actually, in my memory, in Maryland, in the early 90s or sometime in the 90s, I remember the Attorney General of the state, Joe Curran, announcing that he had undergone treatment for prostate cancer and wanted to make a point about early diagnosis, early treatment of prostate cancer, especially for men of his age at that time. But I don't remember being here before with a public figure. Maybe I'm forgetting something else, Barry.
We've never had a public figure at this level with this type of health problem.
Yeah.
The only parallel as far as state government is concerned is when Marvin Mandel was on trial and relinquished his duties to the lieutenant governor, Blair Lee III, who then became the acting governor.
Right.
For 2 years.
Right. That was in 1977, 78, something like that, right?
77, 78. And, yeah. Of course, it got a little bizarre at the very end when Mandel's conviction was overturned on appeal. And one day before Harry Hughes was being sworn in as the new governor, Marvin Mandel marches back into the statehouse in Annapolis, revokes his letter to Blair Lee, becomes the governor once again for 24 hours.
That was a remarkable time. In fact, we're preparing a show on the Mandel trial and the 1970s in Maryland politics. so we'll be talking about that again soon. But you're right, as far as the governor goes, that's the only other parallel there would be, where there's a question about the lieutenant governor. And this brings attention to the lieutenant governor, Boyd Rutherford. But Max, and Kimberly, this is kind of stunning when you think about. I was thinking about this yesterday. A year ago, there were still a lot of people who didn't know Larry Hogan in Maryland. And he ends up pulling off this upset in November. He's gone through, 3 months after taking office, he's helping bring peace and restore order back in Baltimore City after April's rioting. And then here we are. This is kind of a remarkable turn of fortunes. Max, what are your thoughts about it?
It was a stunning surprise, and I'm rather sympathetic to the governor's challenges. I would hope the governor set aside all his public duties and concentrate on his health. That should be the top priority, and his family. I think the lieutenant governor should be capable of handling the day-to-day affairs of the state, and he has a capable cabinet that could carry on their duties as well. So I think the top priority should be the governor's health. He should focus on that and leave public service to those who are in better health and can handle it. But I think the governor in the 3 months he's been in, or 4 months, it's been a rather tough 6 months. The honeymoon was not very long for the governor. And of course, he's in a heavily blue state as a governor from the Republican Party, who I would think stands a very, you have a heavily Democratic legislature, and he was able to win some things, lose some during the legislative session. So I think overall, I applaud the governor for coming forward, and as Barry said, for being transparent. And I think it will help a lot of others who are suffering from similar diseases to take at least some appreciation that someone in such high office has a disease and come forward. So maybe there'll be more funding in research and more attention paid to those who are suffering with the disease or less fortunate.
I was also glad that he decided to be forthcoming, but I was even more, I felt more encouraged of the number of other politicians who stepped forward to also acknowledge his condition and to give warm regards in terms of his present status, including our own mayor.
Including the mayor, Stephanie Rawlings Blake, who has had,
Absolutely.
It's been described as a feud with the governor in the last several weeks. We're going to be talking about that later on in our show, Kimberly. Yes, and to show some humor there, some display of humor, I should certainly takes the edge off, and I'm sure with his staff, people have worked for Larry Hogan, having him inject some humor about this certainly helped in their reaction to it.
But it was also interesting, Dan, that the staff apparently loaded on top of the humor some less than humorous remarks slamming the Democrats for refusing to go along with tax cuts, refusing to go along with budget cuts. Yes.
I'm sorry, I missed some of this. Did this happen yesterday?
Oh, yes. There's a long litany from Hogan about the Democrats refusing to do this and do that and
when
so forth.
Did this happen?
Right after he talked about, I have better chances of beating this than beating, people thought
Brown.
Of beating
Anthony Brown. I'm sorry, I missed that.
I did hear that.
I missed that.
So it was interesting that the staff managed to place into the speech what was clearly sort of an ideological dig, while the rest of the discussion for that appearance was all, you know, very heartfelt and very personal.
Yeah, that's what I was focused on. So I apologize for not noting that, but thank you for noting it. Would you tell our listeners a little bit about Boyd Rutherford? When Boyd Rutherford came in here, we had the two lieutenant governor candidates last year in midday for interview. I remember thinking, why aren't you running for governor? Mm-hmm. I'm sorry. Honestly, that was my answer to him. I was very impressed with him.
Yes, he is a very impressive individual. And he admits, I'm a policy wonk.
Mm-hmm.
I like the nitty-gritty of government. I like solving the little problems that make government run more smoothly and more efficiently. Look, he's a lawyer. He's also got a master's degree. He has vast experience. He was essentially the chief operating officer of the U.S. Department of Agriculture when he was deputy secretary there. And then he ran the Maryland Department of General Services, which really gave him an opportunity to learn everything about all of the other cabinet departments, because that's the agency that essentially services the rest of government. So he understands the bones, the infrastructure of government. So he's just the ideal person, and he has a wonderful temperament, and is a very quiet sort of a background guy who just wants to get in there and do the work. And if I can also say this, Dan, Larry Hogan came into office with the idea that his government would be decentralized, that he'd be the CEO, but he was going to hand off the ball to his cabinet officials, and they basically were going to run with it. Well, this is the perfect opportunity to do just that at a time of the year where there's nothing exciting happening in government, so that they can focus on efficiencies and making things work better.
Barry Raskevar of Political Maryland. That's the name of Barry's blog. Kimberly Moffitt with us and Max Hilaire. We're going to take our first break here on Midday Politics. Yesterday's announcement that Walmart has pulled Confederate flag merchandise from its shelves, along with Sears and Kmart stores, seems to signal a new era in efforts to overcome racist symbols in the wake of the mass shooting of 9 black men and women in Charleston last week and the discovery of the racist photographs and writings of the shooter, the alleged shooter. Calls have come from around the country to curb the sales and promotion of Confederate symbols, and that includes here at home an effort to change the name of a public park that we'll be telling you about in the next segment of our show. And we welcome calls and comments here at 410-662-8780. We'll be right back. And welcome back to Midday, Midday Politics today. Dan Roderick's here. Since the shooting of 9 black churchgoers in Charleston, South Carolina, and the discovery of the alleged shooter's racist motivations, calls have come from around the country, starting in South Carolina, for an end to Confederate symbology. Walmart, Sears, Kmart have pulled Confederate flag merchandise from their shelves. We heard that yesterday, and in a speech yesterday, South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley called for the Confederate flag to be removed from State House grounds. Let's see. I wanted to just read, if you don't mind, panel, just wanted to read a little bit from her speech, Nikki Haley. For many people in our state, the Confederate flag stands for traditions that are noble, traditions of history, of heritage, and of ancestry. The hate-filled murderer who massacred our brothers and sisters in Charleston has a sick and twisted view of the flag. In no way does he reflect the people in our state who respect and in many ways revere it. The South Carolinians view the flag as a symbol of respect. Those South Carolinians view the flag as a symbol of respect, integrity, and duty. They also see it as a memorial, a way to honor ancestors who came to the service of their state during the time of conflict. This is not hate, nor is it racism. At the same time, for many others in South Carolina, the flag is a deeply offensive symbol of a brutally oppressive past. As a state, we can survive, as we have done, while still being home to both of these viewpoints. We do not need to declare a winner and a loser here. We respect freedom of expression, and that for those who wish to show their respect for the flag on their private property, no one will stand in your way. One last piece of this. But the State House is different, and the events of this past week call upon us to look at this in a different way. 15 years ago, after much contentious debate, South Carolina came together in a bipartisan way to move the flag from atop the Capitol dome. Today, we are here in a moment of unity in our state, without ill will, to say it's time to move the flag from the Capitol grounds. That from the Republican governor of South Carolina, Nikki Haley. We'll talk about the local angles on this in just a moment. But first, I want to go to Kimberly Moffitt on this yesterday, because yesterday you made a point of saying this is, what did you say, ancillary, yes, tangential to the main, yes, issues about racism in America.
All of the above. And what I think is this is certainly a big win for social justice activists who want to see something happen to be able to respond to a number of things that we've experienced, at least over the last couple of years in the country, that has something to do with race for individuals. But really, this is a very small win, because the reality is there needs to be a look at the structure that created the symbols in order to understand why that symbol is just that. It's a representation of something, but there's so much more that's embedded into our American fabric that speaks to why that symbol existed in the first place and why so many people are beholden to it.
I can't argue with you. It's just that to me, it's the power is in that symbol, especially when it's on official grounds. You know, when it's on somebody's blue jeans pocket or on a motorcycle jacket.
But I'm disturbed by that too.
I grew up
in North Carolina and was surrounded by that image, mm-hmm, often. And so wherever I saw it, if it was on a flagpole in someone's yard or on the back of a jean jacket or flying somewhere else, I mean, I understand what that symbol means, and I'm disturbed by what it represents. But I think, again, that this becomes one of those deflections from what really needs to be focused on, which is the structure itself.
I can't argue with Kimberly on that, but what about you, Max?
Well, I wonder why now. I mean, the NAACP has been calling for South Carolina to take the flag down. There was a boycott against South Carolina. I particularly was not very pleased with South Carolina continuing to fly the flag, which is an insult to African Americans who are taxpayers in the state of South Carolina, when a public facility, a public building such as the State House, would continue to fly this flag. And I also wonder about the honesty and sincerity of the governor, who for so many years ignored the whole matter and all of a sudden comes up with, you know, wanting to take down the... It's symbolic, but South Carolina has some deep structural problems dealing with racism that the state needs to address, and pulling down the flag is one, but they also need to deal with health disparity, educational disparity, income disparity, disparity in the criminal justice system. And I hope the governor will revisit some of these issues, public policy issues. The governor was very strong on voter ID, very strong on cutting back on early voting, and has not been very sympathetic to the concerns of African Americans. So I'm not sure this is really the true governor coming out speaking about taking down the flag.
You're talking about. And here's another point too, Dan. This was a politically inspired move.
Mm-hmm.
Governor Haley was being inundated with phone calls from national Republican figures, telling her she really had to do this, and the underlying message is for the good of the party. If this were an issue going into the full-fledged presidential campaign, you can imagine the damage that would be done there. And Nikki Haley has aspirations of being a cabinet secretary or even a vice president.
She's in her second term, right?
Yes.
Yes.
And that's it for her, two terms. Yeah.
Yes. So there are a lot of political things at play here. And apparently, I think I read it in the New York Times, one of the most influential phone calls came from Mitt Romney. saying you've just got to take this flag down.
Well, he's been tweeting that for a while.
Yeah.
Well, and let's not forget, South Carolina is very, very important in the
primaries.
And whoever in the Republican Party who can carry South Carolina can use that as the momentum going into Super Tuesday, going into Florida. And I think many of the Republicans who were really indecisive on the talk shows on Sunday and stayed in their position may very well feel happy that the governor has come forward, has created that situation where they don't need to take a position on the flag or even on the death of 9 African Americans in a church.
So that in itself shows us that this is just about a veneer of what needs to be done in an expedient way to make us feel as though something is being accomplished or changed, but the actual structure remains the same. And we've seen that based on some of the actions that the governor has made previously that show that the structure isn't changing, but certainly by removing this symbol, I am showing you in good faith that something is happening.
We're not even certain that the symbol is going to change.
Well, that's true,
because
too.
The state legislature in South Carolina has to approve this. And in Mississippi, where this Confederate flag is on the state flag, one of the corners of it.
Right.
That is also going to take an act of the legislature, and you're liable to have real strong opposition to this, which is going to be interpreted across the country as more white supremacy thinking lingering in these two states.
One thing I just want to ask about the politics of it. Should we expect then that all those Republicans who want to be president, there's a lot of them, you'd have to have 2 nights of debates to get them all on a stage, I think. Do we expect all of them to support this now, given what you were saying about the Republican national agenda?
I think what you're going to have most of them say is, personally, I think they should take it down. However, this is a state matter.
Mm-hmm.
We're back to the states' rights
yes.
issue,
okay.
which was the excuse for waving this flag back in the 1960s.
Right. With the advent of the March
rights.
Of the Civil Rights Movement.
Correct.
Because, Max, what I'm wondering is if this is a battle over who can be more conservative on the Republican side in order to win a primary in South Carolina, maybe you're not so zealous about the flag coming down.
I think they'll all support the governor's move. And again, it's a state matter. The legislature has to approve the removal of the flag. So it gives some kind of cover to Republican presidential aspirants that they don't really have to interject in the matter, because there's not much they could do except take a political stand that would reverberate nationwide. But something I wanted to say is that last week, the Supreme Court ruled in favor of Texas for not allowing a group of, whatever the name of the group
Sons of the Confederate,
who wanted that on their license plate in Texas as a First Amendment free speech right. And the court ruled that it was a state property and that it was the free speech right of the state of Texas, a government of Texas, and therefore Texas had the right to deny, you know, the sons of the Confederate that opportunity.
I'm glad you brought that up, because that brings us home here. The Supreme Court decided that these specialty plates offered by Texas, similar to what we have in Maryland, count as government speech and don't receive the same protection as other speech under the First Amendment. I'm quoting the Baltimore Sun in a story today about how the mayor of Baltimore and others have called for the state to stop issuing these specialty license plates with the Confederate flag. We also have the other local element to this that kind of surprised me yesterday. A friend of mine posted on Facebook a petition to change the name of Robert E. Lee Park. Robert E. Lee Park is a city-owned park in Baltimore County. What did I say?
It's city land in Baltimore County. City-owned land operated by the county.
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
Is it in the city or is it in the
county?
It's in the county, but it's city land, right?
Yes.
Thank you. All right. And people say, well, I always called it Lake Rowland. And I said, all right. Yes, the lake is called Lake Rowland. The park in which the lake exists is Robert E. Lee Park, named in 1945 for the Confederate general. And maybe a lot of people will scratch their heads and say, wait, why do we have a park named after Robert E. Lee in Baltimore? Anyway, so there's a petition circulating around. Next thing I read is that Baltimore County is asking the city to change the name.
They've apparently, Kevin Kamenetz, the county executive, has been working on this for months. Mm. And suddenly the timing was perfect to plunge ahead with this. There's going to be no political opposition whatsoever that counts on this. So it's going to be Lake Roland Park going forward. But, Dan, there's another issue locally that has now been raised, which is Maryland, My Maryland.
The song, the state song.
The state song has very virulent words in it.
Refers to the tyrant. Lincoln is the tyrant, correct?
Correct. And I would think that unless the Hogan administration gets to work on this and heads it off, that you're going to have the state legislature requiring that new words be added to the state song.
Is it the second verse?
I believe it's the second
the one
verse.
They don't sing during the Preakness for the national audience, right? 410-662-8780 is the phone number here. One other thing is the Stonewall Jackson Robert E. Lee statue near in Wyman Park, right?
Yeah.
And the Sons of the Confederacy and the Daughters of the Confederacy, they decide to go there every year and honor Stonewall Jackson and Robert E. Lee. And they picked Martin Luther King weekend this year to do that. And some protesters, several, like 50 protesters showed up there this winter and said, I think they wanted them to stop the commemoration altogether. But they said, can you do this at another time? Because this is so in your face. It's MLK weekend.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us how you feel about this, folks. 410-662-8780.
Problem with that. I like
that's
that.
That's interesting. You're a very interesting guest, Kimberly. You're unpredictable.
I actually like us as citizens being able to commemorate our history in the way that is important to us. And I think as Americans that's very important for us to be able to hold on to. So that part doesn't bother me. I do think when we make decisions to subtly hold commemorations on particular weekends that we know are being used to revere and celebrate another individual, that almost counters some of what may be represented by those organizations, that seems a bit tacky. I'll just call it tacky. But I don't have a problem with groups choosing to commemorate their history in the way that they choose. I think that's very much a basic American right that we're entitled to, and it should be honored and embraced, because I don't want anyone to try and take that from me either. But I do think that there is a time and place for all of those things to occur.
Yes. And it's cool that we live in a country where protesters can show up and say,
absolutely,
no, you shouldn't be doing this
absolutely
weekend, and do it civilly, right? I also think there's a word emphasis here. It's like history. Of course, there's history, right? There's heritage and all. But it's what we choose officially as a state, as a county, as a city to emphasize, right? Putting the name of Robert E. Lee on a park emphasizes something. In 1945, I don't know whose idea this was, probably someone whose ancestors fought for the Confederacy, I assume, or was sympathetic to that cause. So it was emphasized then. Today it offends, right? Today it offends more people than maybe were willing to speak up at the time.
Well, the Confederate battle flag is another example. Some people want to use that as a symbol of their heritage, their ancestors died for in these battles.
Right.
However, it got hijacked in the 1960s. By white supremacists, and that's the only thing you can call them, really. Mm. The George Wallaces, the Lester Mannixes, the racists of the South, which came to dominate white Southern politics, and still has, a real strong hold on portions of the South today.
Mm. Can I throw something else in here before the break? Because I think it's interesting. I want you to think about this and then comment on it after this break. I saw a comment in social media on this that said we should all be proud of our heritage. Heritages, plural. I don't know. There's some people who are not proud of their heritage, of what their ancestors did. And I don't know that that's a carte blanche. That's because, you know, your ancestors did something. It doesn't mean you should necessarily be proud of what they did. I disagree with that statement. And boy, did that conversation go on for a while. I think this was on Facebook. 410-662-8780 to bring that conversation here on Midday with Max Hilaire from Morgan State University, Barry Raskovar of Political Maryland, and Kimberly Moffitt of UMBC. A short break here on Midday. We welcome your calls again. 410-662-8780. Welcome back to Midday. One of our film critics, Christopher Llewellyn Reid, couldn't resist contributing to our discussion here, sends us an email, Confederate flag and Nazi flag. He says, to me, there is no difference between the Confederate flag and the swastika. I have never understood how we have allowed in this country discussions of this racist symbol to revolve around issues of culture and heritage. I imagine that there are some in Germany, especially after World War II, who felt the same way about the flag of the Nazi Party. But the country as a whole repudiated the flag as a symbol of an overthrown and despicable regime. The Confederacy stood for one thing only, slavery, period. Time to finally and irrevocably destroy that old world. Max Hilaire.
Yeah, and then what I was saying is the United States has never taken responsibility for a wrong the country committed against a group of people, African Americans, and also even Native Americans. And until you take ownership of the wrong, and whether it's an apology, some form of reconciliation, whether it's in Germany, in South Africa, and elsewhere, you are not going to, this issue is not going to go away. Injustice never goes away until the state steps up to the plate and accepts responsibility for the wrong it's committed against a certain group of a class of people.
Should we take some phone calls? Barry Raskovar with us as well, and Kimberly Moffitt. Let's hear from Tony, who's on the Eastern Shore. Tony, welcome to Midday.
Hi, thanks for having me on. I thought it's a great point to bring up the Supreme Court ruling about the Texas license plates, the Sons of Confederacy on it, and that issue of state speech. How would that be applied to a state like Mississippi with the stars and bars that are featured on their state flag? And what do you perceive as that tug of war between the federal and state powers and that issue that was just brought up about the United States taking ownership? I'll take my answer off the air.
Well, my reaction to that is this is a state decision, right? The state legislature probably put the stars and bars on the state flag. It's their decision to take it off. Mm-hmm. I don't know how that Supreme Court decision affects that, because the Supreme Court decision has to do with the state issuing license plates, these specialty plates to individuals who desire them. Max?
And the way I look at it is like similar to a passport given to an American citizen. Mm-hmm. The passport belongs to the United States government, and the United States government, I mean, similarly in that same week, the Supreme Court ruled that an American citizen could not get the United States government to put he was born in the state of Israel, having been born in Jerusalem. And again, it's almost the same thing, where the government owns that property and one simply cannot say it's a violation of his or her First Amendment rights to have the government change the rules when it is the United States government that determines what territory should be recognized or what territory should not be recognized. And similarly, the state of Texas or any state should be able to say, well, we choose X on the license plates. And why.
And the Maryland Attorney General, Brian Frosch, says that the Supreme Court decision gives the state the ability to restrict the language and symbols used on license plates. Let's take another call. John in Baltimore, welcome to Midday. Go right ahead, please.
Hello, Dan. Can you hear me?
Yeah, you're doing fine, John.
Yeah, that Jackson Lee statue in Wyman Park, it's interesting. That statue is pointed toward Gettysburg, if you look at it. On the opposite side of the park, the Union soldier is striding toward Richmond. But there's also a Confederate women's monument right in the same area in Homewood.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And you've got a Confederate sailor's monument up near the Maryland Institute, or off of Jones Falls. But I was just curious. You know, we've had many presidential candidates run in North Carolina, either the primary or general election. Among them, Al Gore, John Kerry, Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama. And nobody ever mentioned anything about the flag. I always thought that was curious at the time.
Well, they wanted to win a primary, I guess, so they didn't bring it up. That's why I raised that question about, the flag, maybe it's time for the flag to come down. And the governor of South Carolina leading the way on that now. But as for those Republican candidates who come into the state in the coming year seeking to win the primary there, I wonder, how much talk there will be about this flag. Of course, reporters will ask him all along, I'm sure, Barry.
Oh, yes, it will. And this is going to be a flashpoint when we get beyond the primaries into the general election. And it's going to be a tough one for the Republican candidate who doesn't want to alienate his conservative base, much of which resides in the South. But at the same time, if he plays to his Republican base, he's going to inflame passions on the other side, the Democratic side, especially among minority voters.
Right. I think it will disappear by that time.
Really?
The Confederate flag, I think, will disappear. I think there will be other issues that people will use as a jumping off point from the flag to raise whether or not these candidates are actually interested in dealing with issues that impact people of color, deal with issues of race and racism in our country, inequality, et cetera. But I don't think the flag will be at the center of it.
But I think one thing, Dan, and I heard something on NPR this morning about Governor Scott in Wisconsin, who returned money that was given to him by a group affiliated with this man who committed the
white supremacist group.
Yes, who committed that horrendous crime in South Carolina. So I believe groups that are affiliated in any way with the flag or with white supremacist groups who have donated campaign funds to Republicans, the Republican candidates are going to have a very difficult time justifying accepting monies from these groups or returning the funds.
I think one of the real positives out of all of this, Dan, is that the issue of race and everything that flows out of that in various directions is now going to be front and center for all of the presidential candidates from now until next November.
I think you're right. I just wanted to throw in something else here quickly. Paul Krugman had a piece the other day talking about the long shadow of slavery, similar to the words the president used in his podcast interview with Mark Maron. He talked about the states, the former slave states, that do not have Medicaid expansion under the Affordable Care Act. We have a Supreme Court decision looming on the Affordable Care Act that may affect those states. But anyway, I don't know where South Carolina is. I meant to look this up before we got on the air today. But that's what you're talking about, Kimberly.
Exactly.
That's the real stuff that affects people's lives more than this symbol. And is South Carolina?
Yeah. South Carolina refused the Medicaid expansion.
They did?
Yes.
Okay.
They were very much opposed to the ACA.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you, Max.
I think in the long run, President Obama's podcast is going to be a seminal moment. I really do.
Let's take a minute and talk about this because we aired it yesterday in its entirety, including that word that's the president chose to use, which I found stunning, jarring, remarkable. So let's talk about this. You think this is going to stand up? This is a sort of a historic moment.
Well, I think it's exactly what Kimberly had been referring to, the president used the N-word to make a point. That we have to go deeper than that. You can erase the Confederate battle flag. You can erase the N-word, and nothing changes unless you have this discussion and get to what is driving this anger and bitterness and cruelty in people's hearts. And until you have that discussion, as Max said, as they did in South Africa, for instance, until you have that discussion, you're really just spinning your wheels.
And it needed to happen in his second term as lame duck president, because he never would have said it in his first term, because he saw the backlash that occurred with the, what was it, Beergate, with Skip Gates and the police officer in Cambridge. Yeah. So he recognized what would be the repercussions of trying to raise those hard conversations early on. So now it becomes much easier for him to not only have the conversation, but use a word that's inflammatory so that Twitter blows up and says, what is going on? Mm-hmm. And even this morning, Elizabeth Hasselbeck on Fox News making the comment of, what is going on here? Is he going to use this word in Congress? And being very uncomfortable with the idea. But I think now is the time, and it could be that seminal moment that gets people talking.
Well, I think the president may very well be onto something. I think a lot of African Americans are in a way disappointed that the president has not taken a stronger stance on race issues. And I think there's some who would also like to see the president go further and issue an apology for slavery. If there's anyone who is going to issue that apology, it should be President Obama.
In his second
George
term.
Bush did it in Senegal when he visited Gorée Island, apologized for slavery in Africa, but he never apologized to African Americans for the endurance of slavery and the legacy of slavery. And I think if any president ought to do it, it ought to be President Obama doing it on his way out of office.
I completely disagree. I don't want it to be President Obama because of the symbol that he recognizes. I want it to be
a white person. A white president.
to person. Actually say it.
Yeah.
Because Obama saying it, absolutely, as the leader of the free world, it means something. But coming from that black body means that he is apologizing on behalf of. And I don't think that's where we need to be. I think there needs to be someone else that does so.
I understand, Kimberly, but I don't think it's the person, as it's the office that's issuing the apology. So it's the president.
There have been 42 others
and it's
that could have done
yes,
it.
Yes, but it's the presidency of the United States that is issuing the apology, not the president of the United States.
That's a rich subject for a debate. We should come back to, we should revisit this one. An email from Patricia: Robert E. Lee graduated from West Point and swore an oath, which he went on to betray. Any other president would have had him shot. With the passage of time, he has become almost deified with pictures in silhouette and a halo-type effect. The man was a traitor. Nothing should be named after him. There's a university in Virginia that's at least half of it is named for him.
He was president of that university,
too. That's right. Thank you very much. Barry Raskovar is good. You're all good today. You're all straightening Dan out today. Thank you very much. Ryan in Baltimore on the Confederate flag. Ryan, go right ahead.
My main point is, when it comes to the heritage argument, there was a great article in the Salon, I think, by Tahiti Coates, where he goes into how when the original Confederate flag was instituted, everyone in the Confederacy knew it was about slavery. It was not about states' rights. It was not about anything else. And he goes into detail of Confederate newspapers and articles and things like that, where they blatantly say it's about slavery, it's about white supremacy, it's about the superior white race over the inferior black race. And the argument of states' rights didn't appear until the 50s and 60s, when it wasn't politically correct to so blatantly say it's about this white supremacy.
Okay.
Well, I'm not sure that's an accurate reading of history. The Confederacy needed a flag because they had split off from the United States and were establishing a new country. But I think he's absolutely correct that in the late 1950s and early 1960s, as I said earlier, the Confederate flag was basically hijacked by the white supremacy resistance in the South.
To the civil rights movement.
It's flowed ever since then, and it's taken on a totally different meaning that it is out of context with history.
Frank from Hampstead says the Confederate flag is a symbol of racism. Saying that it is a symbol of heritage is totally bogus. The South went to war with the North because of slavery. It is right there in the Articles of Secession. As a final point, you do not see Germany flying the Nazi flag over World War II cemeteries to honor their history and heritage. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Frank. Alan out in Frederick, thank you for calling in the midday. Go right ahead.
Thanks. It's been a very interesting discussion to listen to this, and I think the discussion has been very important, but I think we should also link this to that football team that's about 45 miles down the road from you.
Yeah, that's privately owned. I guess there's
and
only,
that's the difference
that's
for me.
That's the difference there. Yeah. Only, I agree. It's public pressure is what's needed on that. And you've had it from the White House, too. But, you know, Mr. Snyder doesn't budge on that and goes the other way.
And he's not the only one. I mean,
no,
there
the
are a
one.
Number of those such symbols across this nation that continue to do just that. And I do actually teach that very topic where I vehemently oppose such representation by sports teams. But again, I see it differently because we're talking about something that is a national issue and directly connected to the government versus sports teams being privately owned and out of our control.
And this email, I save this to mention this because this has to do with private property as well. One of our listeners wrote in to ask, how can we remove the Confederate flag displayed on northbound I-95 in Perryville in Cecil County, a mile after the toll booth? It sits on a pole next to the highway, and it's been there for 10-plus years. It's time to come down. We have to speak to the landowner,
yes.
I think.
Well, you also, out in western Maryland, you have Noah's Ark, for instance, right near the highway, that a lot of people probably think has some religious reference that they may disagree with. But
it's a Noah's Ark under construction. Right. It's been there for years.
Yes,
it's near Midlothian, Maryland.
But if you go into West Virginia, for instance, there are crucifixes all over the place in the mountains.
Yeah.
It's on private land.
That's right.
And you see Confederate flags on people's lawns. You see it on their hanging from their houses.
I have seen the one.
It's not very
Caribbean.
Inviting.
It's
I'll
not.
Say that. It's not like you don't want to walk over there and say, "Hey, hi, neighbor."
Lost.
Yeah, I'm lost. I can imagine. It's boy.
But then before wrapping, I just wanted to say, if you notice the identification of this crime in South Carolina, that if it had happened at a Jewish synagogue, automatically it would have been deemed terrorism. And the discussion we are having around, particularly in the Justice Department, as to whether this act in South Carolina is an act of terrorism or is simply a gunman who acted alone and basically chose
or a hate
to,
crime.
Or a hate crime. Right. So I think, again, this director of the FBI came out and clearly denied that this is, you know, categorically said it's not terrorism. But had it happened at a synagogue, automatically it would have been deemed an act of terrorism. So I just want to point that double standard out in terms of how we identify certain crimes in the country.
Charles Ellison was here yesterday with Kimberly, and both agreed that kind of fits the description. Not kind of, it does fit the description of domestic terrorism.
Absolutely. And what I would say to that, though, is the way in which we handle these issues has a lot to do with who the victims are. And in this instance, because we're talking about black bodies, we don't revere them in a particular way that we would equate it to something that needs to be done and done immediately. And so we look for those same bodies to be patient and wait for change demand something different.
Yes, except if you look at the shooting in Denver, in Colorado.
Aurora, you mean?
The Aurora.
The movie house.
Mass shooting. What's been done there? Nothing. I mean, the gun laws went on the books. Now they're coming off the books. So nothing really has changed.
To be continued. I think we should reconvene the same panel and have another discussion about this. It's good to talk about it, although this tragedy in South Carolina is the reason why. We should continue to talk about it. I appreciate Kimberly Moffitt being with us for another day here on Midday. Max Hilaire, always great to have you on the show.
Thanks,
thank you.
Dan.
And Barry Raskovar of Political Maryland, thank you for your insights as well.
Always a pleasure.